And now it's time for the Wildside News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
For 26 years, Hazel the chimpanzee has lived in a sanctuary in Austria, where he has become accustomed to getting his favorite pastries, watching television, greeting his friends with hugs and kisses. But with the sanctuary facing a serious lack of funding, Hazel now becomes a piece of property that can be sold. Until now, animals like the great apes have been treated as things with no more rights than a chair. But an international effort is attempting to have Hazel and other great apes given protections similar to our own. Today, we explore the new persons of interest and bring you the second weekly Earth Summit when your voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
One wonders if a time is coming when the great apes will have guarantees, like us, of life, liberty, and happiness, or is this just the folly of some extreme animal rights advocates? With an increasing understanding that great apes, the chimps, gorillas, bonobos, and orangutans, share a high degree of self-awareness, feel empathy and sorrow, grieve for lost family, remember old friends for years on end, solve complex problems, communicate with one another and with humans using a variety of communication tools. A serious debate is emerging as to what rights these animals, which share over 95% of the same genetic code as we humans, what rights should they have? And some would say, should they have any rights at all? It's a debate that goes back hundreds of years and even finds some of its genesis in the slave trade's past. But a legal battle over the future of a 26-year-old chimpanzee is bringing this question into the European courts. And today, we talk with the president of the Great Ape Project, who is directly involved establishing rights for great apes as persons, with more standing than has ever been afforded non-human beings before. This is a very important issue for anyone who thinks about and cares about the well-being and the survival of the other great animals besides humans on this earth. We'll be going in-depth on this topic in segment 2. But first, we bring you our second weekly Earth Summit, bringing you a dynamic overview of thought and concern from the world's leading nature and environmental voices. So now, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit. Today, our regular panelists provide an overview of thought on issues and observations of our world and your future. So now, we're pleased to open this week's summit with a challenge for all of us from Dr. Matthew Sleeth, who just returned from a month traveling around the country, bringing a call to action to the nation's faith communities.
I have been to the mountain, and it was not there. This is not poetry, but the reality I confronted a week ago in eastern Kentucky. The Appalachian Mountains are being laid to waste in an operation called mountaintop removal. More accurately, it is the mountaintop, middle, bottom, and valley that is destroyed in the process of extracting the 3-foot seam of coal that fuel America's energy needs. Only a poet could do justice to the phenomenon of the missing mountain. It is a hard thing to get my mind around, much less my soul. I lack the skill to convey my horror. Thousands of years ago, a Hebrew poet penned the 148th Psalm, and I quote, "Praise the Lord from the earth, you great sea creatures in all ocean depths, lightning and hail, snow and clouds, stormy winds that do his bidding, you mountains and hills," end quote. How many of those things which glorify our Creator and give beauty to our world will be laid to waste in an effort to fulfill our wants? The answer is in our hands every time we turn on a clothes dryer, television, or lamp. Moses received the Ten Commandments on a mountain, and Jesus preached his greatest sermon on one. He said that if we had the faith, we could move mountains. Now I pray that the same power can preserve the mountains. Lastly, seeing mountains removed and valley streams buried brings into vivid reality the childish notion that we can use non-renewable resources and then pay a fee to offset the result. Once a mountain is destroyed, it is gone, and no carbon indulgence paid can offset or mitigate the sin of its removal.
Thank you, Dr. Sleeth. We now hear a bit of a warning from the president of the Sierra Club, Carl Pope, who offers some different observations on the nature industry.
If you've been feeling sorry for former House Resources Chair Richard Pombo, upset last November by wind power expert Jerry McNerney, stop. Corrupted congressmen always find a safe landing pad. Pombo was signed up with PacWest Communications, a lobbying firm that specializes in making corrupt legislative deals look like good public policy. PacWest, for example, last year won the $3 million contract with the state of Alaska to coordinate a campaign to make it look like the American people wanted to open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to the oil industry. PacWest also wrote Pombo's old bill to gut the Endangered Species Act, then set up a phony front group, the Save Our Species Coalition, to make the bill look respectable, lobbied for it, and topped it off with major contributions to Pombo's re-election campaign. Even so, PacWest may not have hired Pombo just for the past services he rendered them while in Congress. The company's president, Paul Phillips, has a soft spot for the kind of ethical challenges Pombo consistently ran into. In 1990, while he was in the Oregon legislature, Phillips was fined $17,000 for doing pretty much what Pombo did, using his public office to feather his private nest. However scummy PacWest is, it does seem the right kind of employer for Pombo. But there are alarming signs that this job may only be temporary. Pombo's figured out that it is easier to be a corrupted member of Congress, less work, and perhaps more lucrative than to cover up for them. Asked whether he expected to stay with a lobbying business, Pombo recently told the Stockton Record he wasn't so sure. To be honest, I haven't made 100% sure I'm not going to run. I'm just going to wait it out and figure this when things settle down. I want to see if this, meaning taking advantage of the public, is something I want to do again. Of course, if Pombo does run for Congress again, and if the voters are foolish enough to give him the keys to their treasury, PacWest and its clients, the oil, mining, and timber companies, will be the first in the line at his office doors. When are the American people going to realize that the old line, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, and acts like a duck, it is a duck, applies to political ethics? If a campaign contribution or lobbying strategy looks like, acts like, and walks like a bribe, quack.
I want to extend a personal greeting to all Sierra Club members who are joining us now each week for the weekly Earth Summit. Thank you, Carl Pope. Dave Foreman has served in years past on the board of the Sierra Club. As always, he cuts his own path to tomorrow and invites those brave enough to follow.
In my 35 years as a conservationist, I have never beheld such a bleak and depressing situation as I see today. The evidence for my despair falls into three categories: the state of nature, the power of anti-conservationists, and appeasement and weakness within the conservation and environmental movements. I fear that on some level, we must recognize that this state of affairs may be inevitable and impossible to turn around. That is the coward's way out, though. The bleakness we face is all the more reason to stand tall for our values and to not flinch in the good fight. In December of 1776, the American Revolution was in its darkest hour. In response, Tom Paine wrote his first crisis paper, These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of his country. But he that stands it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. General Washington had the paper read to his miserable, disheartened troops in their frozen winter camps. There was no surrender. Years of hard battle lay ahead, but victory was gained. We need Tom Paine conservationists in our dark hour. Let us not apologize for loving wild nature, for caring about other species, for speaking the truth. Reach out to others. Make deals when they are good deals. But let us not be frightened and browbeaten into appeasement. Let us instead offer a bold, hopeful vision for how wilderness and civilization can live together.
I encourage everyone to follow Dave through his work with the Rewilding Institute. Thanks, Dave. A new generation of environmental activists is speaking out to youth across the nation. We're pleased to introduce one of our regular participants to the weekly Earth Summit, Emma Sleeth, who offers a unique perspective to people of all ages. Emma?
In order to save the planet, my generation needs three things: hearts, minds, and strength. A hardened heart is like a haircut. Last year, my friend cut off a foot of her hair for locks of love. Every time I saw her for a month after, I was continually surprised to see gentle waves of brown curling about her ears, no longer able to reach into her customary ponytail. But after a while, I got used to it. Now I have a hard time picturing Hannah with long hair. The same thing can happen with the environment. Every time we hear about the declining state of the ecosystem, we can immediately determine to recycle everything, pick up trash by the side of the road, and carpool more. But then we can lose our enthusiasm. Soon pollution again seems normal. Greenhouse gases and curbside litter unavoidable. Loss of zeal really means loss of heart. In order to make a difference, we must really care about the people that a polluted environment is affecting. To protect the environment effectively, we must also have minds. We must educate ourselves about the state of the ecosystem and where it will be heading in the very near future if we do nothing to intervene. Remember when you were younger and you somehow didn't hear your mom when she called you inside for dinner? Don't worry. The God of the universe hasn't borrowed your mother's floral apron and swatting spoon. But I believe we will be held accountable for what we do or don't do for the environment. With massive climate changes and a plethora of information available to us, saying we didn't know is going to sound pretty lame. The third quality we need is strength. I'm not talking about physical do 100 push-ups at one go kind of strength. No, what I'm talking about is a determination to do what's right, no matter how fruitless or tiring it may seem. Every time I clean my room, I promise myself that I won't let it get messy again. And then the second law of thermodynamics kicks in. Hey, it's the thought that counts, right? Wrong. The Earth does not register good intentions. Protecting the ecosystem cannot become another New Year's resolution, an exercise plan, or a work ethic that fizzles out after 3 weeks. My generation needs to use their God-given hearts, minds, and strength if we are going to change the world.
In the months ahead, we'll be announcing Emma's book on environmental action. We look forward to hearing from you regularly. Thanks, Emma. Our future involves the decisions right before us, as we hope we make the right decisions locally and regionally, which is where most of the effects of climate change will actually be felt. To expand on this perspective, we are given wise counsel by the eminent Dr. Charles Kennel, who provides advice to the world's leading scientific alliances. Dr. Kennel.
The 2007 IPCC report projects a global warming of 0.2 degrees centigrade per decade over the next 2 decades, twice what we experienced at the end of the 20th century. But even if we could hold greenhouse gas and aerosol concentrations back at their year 2000 level, which we have not done and cannot do, we're going to get 0.1 degree per decade for a century or more. And this means that no matter what we do about fossil fuel use, we'll have to adapt to the climate change that's already in store for us. And in particular, California and the American West are going to have to cope with the long-term drying trend. People don't live on the globe. They live in regions and communities. They have their own environments, their ecologies, economics, politics, and social attitudes. While the IPCC can forecast the global drivers of regional climate change, they can't be expected to understand the needs of the citizens living in every region of the world. California has 16 distinct climatic regions, as anyone who drives inland from the ocean can easily appreciate. And Californians care about their 16 regions. We need to do our own assessments. We're already leading the way. The California Energy Commission's Our Changing Climate Assessment set the context for the agreements between California and the UK and amongst the five western states, all to cooperate on climate change. This shows how regional assessments, how influential they can be. Assessments are going to have to become a way of life for California. State agencies will use them in important water management and natural hazard decisions. How high and when should we rebuild the levees in the Sacramento Delta? Farmers and the banking institutions that finance agriculture need them. The Department of Forestry will use their wildfire forecasts. Energy companies will use their forecasts of electricity usage and hydropower generation in making their investment decisions. Environmental managers in our cities, towns, and parks will use them. The protection of California's ecosystems and wildlife will depend on them. Fisheries managements will use them. In 10 years' time, climate science may be able to reduce the lead time of its forecast to 10 years. This would give highly actionable information to investors and government, and we should adopt this as a goal for California now.
Regional thinking is where you live. Perhaps the term bioregional perspective may stage a comeback. Thank you, Dr. Cannell. We are all in this together. Dr. Thomas Lovejoy knows this as well as anyone. Dr. Lovejoy, thanks for your thoughts this week.
Now, we recently had the report of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about the impacts of climate change on the natural world. And I think it's quite clear now that the natural world is the most sensitive of all the things we care about that can be affected by climate change. We're seeing changes in nature all over the world, changes in flowering time, changes in nesting time, species changing where they live, changing in altitude, changing in latitude. We're seeing mismatches where one species in a relationship depends on day length, the other depends on temperature, and suddenly they're no longer in sync. And we're seeing thresholds passed in ecosystems so that, for example, in the Northwest and British Columbia and southern Alaska, the coniferous forests are suddenly being attacked in a major way by a native pest, the pine bark beetle. But with warmer summer nights and essentially longer summers, suddenly the balance is tipped in their favor. So there are places where 70% of the trees are dead. So basically, if we allow climate change to go on business as usual and get worse, we're going to see the very biological underpinnings of human society be shaken in an unprecedented way. So nature is telling us it's time to get the climate change and greenhouse gas problem under control.
In order to truly build a global response, it will take the united efforts of professionals from around the globe. Building that effort through action, we now invite Dr. Robin Moore to invite everyone around the world interested in the future of amphibians to begin building that united effort. Dr. Moore?
In September 2005, over 60 of the world's leading experts in amphibian conservation and research convened in Washington, D.C. for an amphibian summit. This summit was a response to mounting evidence over the preceding decades that amphibians have been going extinct and declining worldwide. This realization prompted the global community to come together to formulate a response. The summit tackled a number of themes from disease, climate change, captive breeding and reintroduction to develop a global strategy in the form of the Amphibian Conservation Action Plan. This action plan will be published within the next couple of months. Associated with the action plan was a budget of $400 million. This is the amount it was estimated it would cost to halt the crisis. Prior to the summit, a number of disparate bodies had been tackling amphibian conservation at the global scale. The Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force had made amazing advances in our knowledge of amphibian declines worldwide. The Global Amphibian Assessment had provided an update on the status of amphibians and continues to provide an update on the status. Following the summit, it was realized that a unified global entity was required to tackle the problem at the scale necessary. This led to the formation of the Amphibian Specialist Group, into which the Declining Amphibian Populations Task Force folded, and the Global Amphibian Assessment will also fold. If you'd like more information about the Amphibian Specialist Group, including the bi-monthly newsletter Froglog, which details the activities of the Amphibian Specialist Group and amphibian researchers working in the field, please visit the website www.amphibians.org.
We must unite our observations of the changes taking place. That means we all have to pay attention to the real world around us. Dr. Mark Beckhoff sends us onward with some of his observations on how paying attention to the wild creatures applies to our broader lives. Dr. Beckhoff.
Yeah, one of the really interesting things that I try to do is people ask me, well, what is knowing about animal behavior do for you in terms of encountering a wild animal? I'll say, well, when you see a mountain lion, you're supposed to stand upright and scream and make yourself really big. If you have a bike, wave the bike. If you have a stick, wave the stick. Of course, what I've done in the past when I've had the lion encounters is I run, because that's what you instinctively do. But people are also interested in practical issues, like what happens when a real aggressive dog comes up to you. Well, what I generally do is I turn and walk away very slowly. Sometimes I'll face the dog, but generally I'll turn around and I'll walk away slowly. I won't make any sudden move. I surely won't run away fast, although I want to, because that's like a pursuit invitation signal, we call it. That's an invitation for the animal to chase you. Some people say that if you roll over and you're really scared and you pee in your pants, that might work, and it might. I've never done that. But my tendency with a real aggressive dog is to just get away slowly, simply because they can be pretty unpredictable. And you just, you know, you don't know about the history of the dog. You don't know the dog's psychological makeup. And so by lying down, you may, you know, be exposing a vulnerable part of your body. So I think that, you know, those are sort of lessons from animal behavior. When I encounter coyotes around my house, once again, I walk away slowly. I may say, you know, I may talk to them in a really, really gentle, mellow voice. But, you know, sometimes with a mountain lion, you have to confront them. With this bear on my porch, I didn't know what to do. And, you know, I've heard reports from other people about, you know, bears and even coyotes, that they're so habituated, this bear didn't flinch. He finally ran off my porch when I went to the door, and I was standing at the screen door, and I was starting to close the glass sliding porch door, and I noticed he was backing up a bit, so I opened the door a bit, because I knew I could actually shut it before he could get in it, and I just kind of looked at him, and very gently I said, "What are you doing here? You know, please leave my porch." And then when I stepped towards him, and I was probably only about 3 feet from him, but still protected partly by the door, he ran off the porch. So there's a problem, I think you can see, that with habituated animals, you just don't know what to do. The other problem, of course, is a lot of these animals have been shed, and then they people stop feeding them, and that's the worst of the worst situation. When you read about kids getting attacked by wildlife or even adults, it's because the wildlife have been fed, and then they stop feeding them, and they're accustomed to food.
I want to thank this great alliance of advocates that will be meeting and sharing their thoughts each week on the weekly Earth Summit here on the Wildside News. Now do what you can, which means to spread the word about the most important 15 minutes on Earth until we convene again next week. This is your host, Sydney Wildsmith. See you then. Tune in each week for the weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Coming up, should Hazel, the 26-year-old chimpanzee, be offered the same rights as any other person? The legal debate is taking place as we speak. this precedent-setting court battle is gaining traction in Europe, and there's plenty of interest here as well. Stay tuned as we go in-depth with the president of the Great Ape Project when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.